Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Thanks very much for tuning in here. We appreciate you being with us. On the program today, in this first hour, we will be talking with another speaker from the series that's called the Friday Forum, a series of noontime talks that have happened now for many years at the University of Y. Down on the campus, there's a series in the fall and the spring. They're all organized around a particular topic, and then guests approach it from different sorts of directions. And this morning, we'll be talking about looking at some of the concerns that college students have about the university-licensed clothing items that they buy, things like hats and T-shirts and sweatshirts. Around this country, it seems that there are a growing number of Americans who are interested in working conditions for workers around the world that make things that we buy here in the United States. And one group that has started to take an interest in that and started to be rather vocal about that is college students who want to know who's making their shirts and T-shirts and other sorts of gear. Last fall, the Nike Corporation, along with St. John's University, sponsored a series of trips, for students to visit the factories that produce Nike's university-licensed apparel. These trips, most of them actually took place this year on spring break, while students were on spring break. This morning, here in this part of Focus, we'll be talking with John Dolly. He is a student here at University of Illinois in general engineering and philosophy, and he was one of the representatives who went on this trip. He'll be talking today at the Friday Forum about his experiences and what he saw, and was good enough to come in here and talk with us, so all of those people who couldn't go to the forum can hear what he has to say. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. All we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so we can keep things moving along. But anyone's welcome to a call. Just remember, you're sharing the space with the other callers. 333-9455, that's the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point, you have questions, you can call us. Well, thanks very much for coming and talking with us.
It's good to be here, David.
How did this all get started?
Well, to give you a little bit of background on where my interest stems from, I actually was involved in service quite a bit in high school with church youth groups as well as with scouts and other things. And so when I came to college, I got interested in service as well and got involved actually with a program at the University YMCA called Alternative Spring Break. From that program, I kind of got interested in the idea of experiential education and also learning from communities and in general, just kind of social concerns, issues, after taking several trips there. I also, at that point in time, decided that I wanted to double major in philosophy and met a professor here at the University of Illinois by the name of Robert McKim. And that professor, over the summers, had been teaching at a new private university in Bangladesh. And at the point in time when I took his class, I got very interested in having students, having a visiting students program. And so I ended up going over my second summer here at the university to North-South University in Dhaka, Bangladesh. And it's interesting, after you do a study abroad program like that, what an interest you can all of a sudden take in that country and anything that comes up about it. Well, at one point in time, about a year later, I got an email looking for student representatives to monitor working conditions in Nike factories, specifically those factories that produced university licensed apparel. And one of the biggest industries in Bangladesh is apparel, and garments in general. So I decided to kind of pick up on that, and I applied. And I got some supporting letters from the university and whatnot. Unfortunately, I didn't end up going to Bangladesh because they had another student who was a little bit more qualified and that she was from India and spoke actually the Bengali part of India and spoke Bengali and also was female, which I think is an advantage when you're going in and trying to talk with garment factory workers who are predominantly female in a culture that is much more favorable to interaction between females rather than an outside male kind of coming in. So that was kind of what inspired me to apply.
Now, who did Nike actually pay for all of this?
Nike funded all of it, though I think that there was a considerable cooperation on the part of a monitoring agency called PricewaterhouseCoopers. I think that they were also interested in improving their process. So the actual monitoring occurred with us accompanying representatives from PricewaterhouseCoopers to each of the different factories. Perhaps I should say a word about the way monitoring works within Nike. Nike has two main ways of monitoring the conditions of factories. One, they do internally, which is Nike representatives actually go, and they do what they call shape inspections. And shape inspections stand for safety, health, attitude of management, personnel and environment, and are focused mostly on OSHA regulations. The external monitoring program is done and contracted with PricewaterhouseCoopers, who actually goes and does more of an auditing approach to the factories. They focus more on looking at financial reports and also interviewing workers, and that's the one we went on. And I think that it was a combination of being an interest on the part of Nike, who provided most of the financial support, but also a flexibility on the part of PricewaterhouseCoopers to be open and accommodating to having students go and participate.
Mm. Well, maybe here I should introduce again our guest, anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit here. We're speaking with John Dolley. He's a student here at the University of Illinois. He's a senior. He studies engineering and philosophy, and he was one of a group of students, college students from around the country, who were involved in this program that that he has just sort of explained, that was jointly sponsored by Nike with the involvement of PricewaterhouseCoopers and also St. John's University. 15 students visited garment factories that were producing Nike's university-licensed clothing, they did produce some reports. And, in fact, you can look at what they produced by going to Nike's website. It's posted there, and I'm assuming that you all have looked at what Nike has posted there, and
absolutely,
you feel that they've been faithful in representing what it was that you found.
Yeah, they've done a fairly good job. I would say some of the responses were a little bit trite, but they published the report that we wrote, and it's about a 50 or 60 page report, unedited, on their website. They offered suggestions and along the way, but they left it up to us as far as what we decided to include in the report, and that's posted there in its entirety. There's actually a lot of information on the Nike website. So if you're very interested in this issue, I would highly recommend you go there and just browse around. You can see also individual reports from each of the different students that they wrote back, as well as kind of our combined report. And maybe even more interestingly, you can see Nike's response to all of the recommendations that we made.
So tell me about where you talked about how you had this interest in India and thought it would be interesting to go there, and it turned out that you didn't end up going there. Where did you go?
Well, I was actually interested in Bangladesh, but
yes, Bangladesh.
It's all right. I actually ended up staying in the United States, as kind of disheartening as that was. I went to really two factory locations, one in Bourbon, Missouri, and the other in Huntsville, Alabama. One of them was focused primarily on printing and embroidery. They didn't actually produce the garments there. They just did the printing and embroidery on them. The other produced headwear and all sorts, a whole variety of hats, and went through and spent a day at each of those locations. And it was a very interesting process. Mm. I would say, by and large, the management was fairly receptive. I should say, maybe I should clarify a few things. And one is that if you're not familiar with the way the garments industry is kind of set up, a lot of the factories now are contracted out. So these factories that we're going to are not actually owned by Nike. They're owned independently and contract with a whole range, maybe as many as 30 different apparel names that you'd be familiar with, whether it's Gap or Eddie Bauer or whatever. So at any one time, there may be no production from Nike going through these, or that maybe 25% or more of production is Nike's. Part of that being that the garments industry is also very seasonal. So when we went through, we didn't actually see any Nike garments on the assembly line, though we did see it obviously being in the stored in the warehouse and things like that. However, it's the same facility that would be producing that, depending upon, you know, the time frame and when they're placing the orders. Also, all the garments factories we went to were those garments factories which have contracts with universities and Nike. So it's the university-licensed apparel garments factories. Nike probably has over 800 garments factories globally. We only looked at about 32 of them, though we did see nearly every garments factory that Nike has that does produce university-licensed apparel. There were a few we didn't get to see, but that was largely a result of just timing, and it wasn't anything that Nike did to try and make sure we wouldn't go to this factory or that factory.
Mm. Well, what were some of the specific things that you and the other students going to other places were interested in?
I think everybody had their own motivation for going. What we were looking for primarily was to kind of gauge the feedback we could get from workers there. We were very interested in finding out what their perceptions were of the workplace. And one of the things that I can say, I think without hesitation, was that a lot of that has to do with the culture in which you're working in. And so while the challenges that are faced in an American factory are probably very different than those in Central America and different than those in Asia, American workers, from my experience, spoke very freely about the working conditions in the factory. So some of the concerns that you might have about confidentiality and intimidation, those weren't things that I sensed in the two or three factories I visited. I say two or three because one of them only had 10 employees and had actually just been bought out by the other one I monitored, so they were kind of lumped together. Whereas in other countries, intimidation was a little bit bigger factor because the interviews that we do occur within the factory setting. They occur independently in rooms that are separate from where managers might be have access to. But there were one of the problems we faced was, you know, different management take a little bit more leeway as far as walking in and out of those rooms and running errands and things because they are trying to run a business. And while I don't think anybody felt that any information that was shared by employees, you know, that there was a violation of that trust with that employee, they do try and do it anonymously. It does create an environment that doesn't provide for the most security, then as far as the employee feeling comfortable sharing any complaints they might have.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure that you and the other students who went looked at a number of things like wages, yeah, working conditions, how long people work, what was the factory like, and what sort of things the workers said about, you know, how they were treated, what their supervisors were like, all those sorts of things. What sort of sense do you come away with? And I expect also that probably, as you say, that conditions, issues, wages, all that kind of stuff, it's going to be very different from one place to another,
right,
particularly when you compare conditions for American
right.
workers here in the United States mm-hmm. with those in Asia or in Latin America.
I would say, again, the things that we looked for in the audits were primarily, first, we looked at the financial reports, and we wanted to make sure when you go through a factory, the rule of thumb is you either interview 10% of the employees or with a maximum of 25. So some of the factories that people went to, like in Bangladesh, where there were literally thousands of employees, they looked at 25 interviews. And then from those employees they interview, they also, and those are chosen kind of at random, though there is a little bit of strategy to it. Usually, I'll take you through kind of the steps that we went through in a typical day. Mm-hmm. When you first arrive at the factory, you go and you meet with the management, and you kind of talk to them, and they kind of give you an informal tour of the facilities. Any facility component that is a part of the process in making the apparel is one that monitors have a right to see. Again, these visits are organized ahead of time. They know we're coming. And that does, one of the concerns is that may have an impact on the response. But that's the first step. We go on that tour, and then we have some time to just kind of walk around on our own. And as we do that, we try and look for employees that maybe look younger, or that maybe are working in higher stress areas. We try and make sure that while it's somewhat random, that we don't accidentally get all of our employees working in one segment of the factory. We want kind of a representative sample, so there is some focus that way. We also look for those employees that we tag to kind of interview later. We also look at their financial records and look to make sure that the wages that they've been receiving are appropriate for the job they're performing and that the hours that they're working are within the standards, which is typically 60 hours a week on average. No more than 20 hours overtime is what's required. There also has to be considerable knowledge of labor laws based on the location, because it's the responsibility of the monitors to also make sure that they're not only not violating Nike's code of conduct, but also not violating whatever the laws are in that area. So if you're in Bangladesh, you have to make sure you're not violating Nike's code of conduct and not violating Bangladesh's local labor laws, whatever is more strict.
We do have a caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation. In Champaign County, it's line number one.
Yeah. David, I'm sure you've done the research on this, and I can't remember several pivotal names. I've been suffering from a malady this week. But anyway, I understand that the Price Waterhouse monitoring group is the group that the U of I didn't pick. I don't know if that's wrong or not. There has been a lot of contestation about which group to pick, and this, I don't remember the two names of the two monitoring groups. The Price Waterhouse monitoring group is regarded more as the industry monitoring group, and I also remember the story about Phil Knight, I guess, who was alumni of the University of Oregon, withdrew his endowment to the university after they selected the, quote, wrong monitoring group, which is the more independent monitoring group, which I believe the U of I was pressured into. Now, does this framework fit into what you're talking about at all?
I mean, yes, it does. It's a separate issue, but it's a very relevant and related one, and that has to do with the labor group that you're talking about is actually not PricewaterhouseCoopers. It's the two organizations of the Fair Labor Association and the Worker Rights Consortium. And the Fair Labor Association, and the purpose of these groups, these are all newly formed groups. Neither of these have begun actual monitoring. From what I understand, they're still under construction, so to speak. They're still kind of recruiting membership and developing their base, developing their process, doing those sorts of things. So the way that it works right now, Nike has joined and supports the Fair Labor Association, which is a kind of a group that I'll try and kind of draw a few of the distinctions, but again, this isn't an area that I'm very expert in. The Fair Labor Association involves both companies and NGOs and universities in kind of a group forum, and they look to do an outside monitoring process that draws on local resources and kind of sets a minimum standard. While right now there's a Nike code of conduct, the Nike hopes, and I think a lot of companies in the industry hope, that there's a trend towards sort of a universal code of conduct. One of the kind of interesting things as you go into these factories is while you think of, you know, Nike having a code of conduct, most of these factories have a wall of conduct because they do contract with a lot of different companies. And so there could easily be 12 to 13 to 15 to 20 different codes of conduct within a single factory. And the expectation that the employees know and understand all of those codes of conduct is kind of a suspicious one. I mean, it's really an impossible task because, I mean, the concepts are complicated. There's so much overlap, and then there's these differences. So the hope is that they'll come towards a universal code of conduct in some way, shape, or form that sets more of a floor rather than a ceiling. So there may be other instances in which, you know, a university or whatever requires more than that, but at least they come to some uniform base, and it's just not completely disparate, you know, codes of conduct. The Workers' Rights Consortium was started by students and student activists and does not have a seat at the table, so to speak, for companies. And that is why Nike is so critical of the WRC. And one reason that, they didn't withdraw, I think this number could be wrong, but it's approximately $15 million worth of support Phil Knight withdrew when the University of Oregon chose to join the WRC. And incidentally, the University of Illinois is a provisionary member of the WRC right now. There's about 67 universities that have kind of signed on to the WRC. There are 147, I believe, that have signed on to the FLA, the Fair Labor Association. And they really, right now, are trying to work together. But there's some tension between the two groups because they have slightly different focuses. They have different approaches to monitoring as far as, you know, one is much more focused on spot visits. The WRC is a much stronger proponent of, you know, the concept of living wages, whereas the FLA is a little bit more hazy about it. There's a lot of distinctions between these groups, though. I think there's a lot of potential for them to be ultimately something that kind of goes beyond Nike sphere and looks at the whole industry. One other important difference between the two groups is that the Workers' Rights Consortium is only focused on garments factories that have and produce university-licensed product, whereas the FLA is looking at the entire garments industry.
Well, of the number that this Price Waterhouse, which I gather is outside of both of these, is more of a Nike-funded thing, you didn't go outside of the U.S. to see the primary contractors. Did some number of this group that you were affiliated with do that?
Absolutely.
And you can go to the National Labor Committee website, where Charles Kernighan, his specialty is going out and pretending to be an investor and asking the contractors that Nike and all the rest of the outfits go to what they can offer. And he's investigated and toured a lot of these plants. I don't know if he's going to have plastic surgery so he can keep doing this or what. He's gotten away with it in a lot of different areas.
Students actually did talk to...
Well, I have to go now, but the conditions are wretched. Vietnam is full of, people that are working exceptionally long hours. It's mainly young women. It's places where the fumes from the glue of the manufacture of these, $130 shoes are not sufficiently disposed of, ventilated, et cetera, et cetera. So... I hope we do get some transparency on these issues, and I'll hang up and listen to the rest, and thanks a lot.
All right. Well, go ahead.
You brought up some good issues there. I know some of the students actually did talk with Charles Kernighan, who does, as part of his living, go and monitor these factories. I should say, again, we focused only on the garments factories. The shoe industry is a separate issue, partly because factories that produce shoes are more likely to have substantial contracts with a company like Nike. So a single shoe factory might produce almost entirely Nike shoes, whereas the garments industry, you run into the complexity of having a single factory dealing with many, many more contracts outside of a single company like Nike. As far as the factories we actually went and visited, we did go to every factory that produces collegiate licensed product, and that included factories in Bangladesh, factories in Indonesia, factories in Korea, factories in the Dominican Republic, factories in Guatemala, factories in China, factories in Taiwan, all over the world. And the reports, if you look on the Nike website, reflect that and reflect some of the different, you can see trends in the different regions. And if you read the compiled report, you'll also be able to see when the students got together, and we did get together after we had all gone on our trip and wrote in a weekend this kind of massive report summarizing our findings by region. You can see what some of the different concerns were in different regions. In the United States, the concerns had to do sometimes with language barriers because you run into some of the most multicultural factories where you can have people of 6, 7, 8 different ethnicities. So you have codes of conduct that have to be posted in 6, 7, 8 languages. When you go abroad, you run into some other difficult cultural conflicts. For instance, in Latin America, some of the factories have almost, in Guatemala, for instance, a lot of the factories are managed by Koreans, but most of the employees are Guatemalans, and that creates a different sort of cultural barrier there. In Bangladesh, you run into some of the issues of most of the garments factory workers being women, and so there is, as far as people feeling free to go and speak out or against what's going on in the factory. There's also a different set of values, and this comes down to also one of the challenges in creating a living wage. People have different priorities as far as, you know, what constitutes a minimum standard. And one of the important things is that we not export American standards of living or American ideals to other countries, because that may not be what they want. You know, if setting a particular ideal is going to limit the number of jobs that are available or the number of hours workers can work, as hard as this may be, it may not be in the workers' best interest all the time. And so it's important that studies be done, and there are organizations that are doing these sorts of studies. One of them, that Nike, this is kind of the third part of the Nike monitoring program, though it's also not very far underway. There's an organization called the Global Alliance, and the Global Alliance is one that's involved in it right now, or the World Bank, which most people may not take as a ringing endorsement, but the World Bank is involved in that. I know both St. John's University and Penn State University have signed on, as well as a few handful of other organizations. I think the International Youth Foundation. But in short, this organization is charged with actually going out and doing in-depth studies, not just of the workers' life in the factories, but in the workers' life in their communities, and trying to find out what it is that will substantially improve the lives of the workers in the appropriate cultural context. And that even goes beyond issues of living wage to larger issues like corporate citizenship and the sort of relationship that corporations should have with these communities.
Which is a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me again introduce our guest. We're talking this morning with John Dolley. He is a student representative of the Nike Factory Monitoring Committee. And again, as we've sort of explained, that the Nike Corporation, PricewaterhouseCoopers, St. John's University all were jointly involved in sponsoring 15 students who visited garment factories that were producing Nike University licensed apparel. So here we're not talking about shoes, but we're not talking about other things, hats, sweatshirts, T-shirts, shorts, and that kind of stuff. They traveled various places around the world. John, he visited a couple of places here in the United States. Most of this travel took place over the spring break of this year. The students came back. They wrote reports. A lot of this information is available, posted on the Nike website. So if you want to look at it, it's www.nikebiz. That's as one word, N-I-K-E-B-I-Z, nikebiz.com. John is a senior here at the U of I in general engineering and philosophy, and we'll be talking about this as part of the Friday Forum series today, a little bit past noon, the University Y on the campus. So if you're interested in hearing more, you can go down there and hear him. It's free and open to anybody who would like to attend. And also questions here are welcome, 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Just to go back to a question I'm sure that some people would have, I think you partly touched on this, but given the fact that one of the sponsors of the trip was Nike, and also the PricewaterhouseCoopers were involved, and some people may not be sure just how objective that organization is. Mm-hmm. And given the fact that the places that you and the other students visited knew that you were coming, mm-hmm. Some folks, I'm sure, will question all of that and say, well, they were sponsored by the company. They knew that you were coming. Obviously, they're going to make sure that everything that you see is on the up and up, and that you're not going to see anything that's going to be real problematic. Did you all feel that, in fact, you got to see things as they were, and the company was not deliberately steering you to see things so that you would come away with a generally favorable impression?
That's an excellent question, and I have to say that when we initially met to go through the weekend training program that occurred in the fall of 1999, when kind of the 15 of us all got together at St. John's University in New York City, that very question was on each and every mind as we thought about, you know, what the implications were of participating in this program. None of us wanted to become all of a sudden a mouthpiece for Nike. However, one of the things that you have to understand is that Nike had no idea what we were going to say when we came out of that, and they've never you know, if they tried in any way to manipulate us, that's the first thing we would shout. And that, I think that would have received a considerable amount of attention. Now, as far as the experience that we had when we went to the factories, again, we didn't see every factory that Nike produced garments in. In fact, we saw only a very small fraction. But in, I think some of the general impressions that we got coming away from that were one, Nike was actually more open about what we did in the factories and the what we explored and the way we documented things than PricewaterhouseCoopers, which does this for a business. They were, you know, as far as going in and taking pictures and doing things like that, and a lot of times Nike was even in favor of that, but it was PricewaterhouseCoopers who kind of reined them back and said, you know, we need to, there's a certain procedure we need to follow and things like that. I think Nike's approach to this was, in, by and large, let's just kind of see what happens. I think Nike wants to be known as an innovator and wanted to do this program to, in part, respond to student complaints and the sense that they were, that they had made huge improvements, but that students were recognizing that. And I think there's some truth to that. I would say from what I experienced in talking to the managers at the factories that we did visit, I think they all seem to think, and I can't say this absolutely, but the ones I talked to at least, seem to have the impression that Nike was in many ways kind of pioneering the way. Again, we can only speak on the factories that we did visit, and a growing problem is kind of these clandestine factories that, that subcontract and other things. And another issue is how far down the supply chain you actually go and monitor. So for even the factories that we did go to, you know, we looked at those factories that directly supply Nike, but we didn't look at the factories that supply that factory, the factories that supply, the factories that supply that factory. And so one of the things that I think people hope happens is that the accountability kind of goes, that at least the folk, you know, that people at least, you know, go one step back, and so that the factories that Nike contracts with, they encourage them to in some way, shape, or form monitor where they get their products from and where, who their suppliers are. The extent to which that happens is still very much up in the air, and that is, a, as the caller mentioned, an important consideration as we think about these things and as the garment industry grows. But in the information age, I think that there is a higher standard of accountability. I think that there are good organizations like the FLA and the WRC, that's the Fair Labor Association, and the Worker Rights Consortium, both of which whose websites I would recommend you look at. The Fair Labor Association, their website is www.fairlabor.org. The Worker Rights Consortium is actually www.workersplurals.org. Both of those are also excellent resources. There are some papers on those that kind of compare and contrast the two organizations and talk a little bit about the bit of animosity between them. But I think that one of the most important things to come out of this, if I were to kind of recap, is that I think if nothing else, this having a program like this keeps the issue being talked about and keeps it alive on college and university campuses. And I think that alone makes it worthwhile. I don't feel like our concerns were misrepresented. I think Nike took them fairly seriously. I think PricewaterhouseCoopers took them somewhat seriously. And I think that there are incremental improvements that will be made as a result of this program. There's a lot more that needs to be done, though.
Mm. Well, and I mentioned the fact that that you all went on these trips just this past spring, so it hasn't been that long,
right,
since
correct.
You came back. So, but at this, based upon what it is that you wrote about and the recommendations that you all made, has anything changed yet, or would we say, well, it really hasn't been enough time yet?
I think it kind of depends on the issues, and when we addressed issues in our reports, we did it in two ways. We kind of addressed the immediate pressing concerns. What were the violations in the factories that we saw? Where we made those concerns known, many of those concerns were the same concerns that were represented in the PricewaterhouseCoopers report. Those changes were affected immediately. Those were followed up on, and most of them have been alleviated. So where, for instance, when there was a Sharps container missing for the tag guns that they used to put tags on the garments, that sort of thing being noticed, or where there weren't full reports of all the wages, or where there wasn't accurate accounting, or where there wasn't appropriate documentation. In one instance, where there was an underage worker who was 15, who incidentally over the course of investigating turned 16, so it didn't even become an issue dramatically. Those sorts of things were addressed immediately. But there were there was kind of a broader spectrum, in that we also wrote some sort of global recommendations as far as what we think Nike needs to be looking at and PwC needs to be looking at as they kind of look at this auditing process into the future, and what sort of improvements they can make in the broader spectrum. And those sorts of recommendations included things like expanding the monitoring process from a one-day sort of venture to a two- or three-day sort of venture that allows for a more thorough job being done in larger factories. Another sort of recommendation was that they experiment with doing some unannounced visits, monitoring visits, particularly for factories that they've had trouble with in the past. Those sorts of things, I believe, Nike is trying on sort of a provisional basis. Have they implemented it across all their factories? No. What they have told us that they are doing is that they are trying them on a provisional basis right now. And if you look on the website, you'll see that that's what they say in their report. What's important is that we follow up and that we kind of accurately assess the results. And also that we need to look seriously at PricewaterhouseCoopers. And while I think they do a good job, they have an idea of what's right and what's wrong, and by the way they approach the whole auditing process, there's so much that they can do to try and make unannounced visits work. And the question is, are they doing everything they can? Do they really see the value in that? And I think there's sort of a mixed response to that question.
I wonder what you might say about how much concern there is at the university among university administrators about this, and in fact whether if it was not for the fact that the students seem to think that this is an important issue, whether the university would think that it was an important issue.
That's an excellent question. As far as the latter part, whether if students didn't think it was an important issue, administrators would, I don't know how to answer that, and I'm not sure that they would or not. I think that there would be certainly be some administrators, some faculty, in fact, who would say it's an important issue. But I think it's the students who pay the tuition and the salaries of a lot of the administrators and faculty at this university that I have had a lot of influence. I know that it's students that have pushed Nike, and they've even said this. Nike would not have gone as far as it did without pressure from students. As far as the support the university has for this sort of program, I'm glad you asked that question. In fact, I've been very impressed with the University of Illinois, and that when this program, the opportunity for this program first presented itself, I had to get some letters of recommendation. And one of the first people I went to was Vice Chancellor Askew. And after about a 10-minute presentation, as I kind of impassionately said, I really think this is a good thing for the university to do, and if you could just support me on this, it would be wonderful. She paused for a moment and she said, we need to make this happen. And she wrote me an extremely strong letter of recommendation, without which maybe I wouldn't have even been chosen for the program, and that impressed me deeply. The university has also formed a licensing advisory committee, and I think that that is an important step. The University of Illinois has been slow compared to other universities, but I think that that just shows or demonstrates a sort of cautiousness, and I think that that's actually very beneficial, because some universities, like Georgetown, rushed in a little bit more quickly and joined the Fair Labor Association, and then several months later ended up withdrawing their participation because they later decided that the FLA wasn't representing or wasn't doing enough to represent the workers' needs and what needed to be done as far as monitoring practices. So I do think it's cautiousness. I do think that the university is taking this very, very seriously, and I I appreciate that. I hope to be a little bit more involved here in the rest of this year on campus, and if I stay for graduate school with the licensing committee. And right now, the university is a provisional member of the Worker Rights Consortium. But in fact, this coming week is meeting with representatives from the Fair Labor Association who are coming in from D.C. and New York to consider and look at more seriously membership of that organization as well. So I feel like the university's done a decent job. But on the same token, I think university students, faculty, and administration need to continue to pressure for change.
We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less. Our guest is John Dolley. He's a student here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and he's a senior in general engineering and philosophy and was one of a group of college students who were involved in this program we've talked about that was jointly sponsored by Nike, by PricewaterhouseCoopers, and St. John's University in New York. 15 students visited garment factories, some of them in Asia, some in Latin America, some here in the United States, that were producing university-licensed apparel for Nike. And they went there, talked with workers, talked with people who ran the factories, came back, produced some reports. Both reports specifically on the places that they went and a kind of a global summary report that is available on the Nike website. And John says he thinks that it's the straight stuff. So if you're concerned that Nike was doing censoring and or editing, he says no.
It's what we wrote.
That's what they wrote. So you can look at www.nikebiz.com. And you can also see the responses that the company made. And questions welcome here as we move into about our last 8 or 9 minutes. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, I asked you about the university and whether they were concerned about this issue. I know obviously there are some students that are concerned about this issue, but I wonder if you have some sort of feeling for, generally speaking, your average University of Illinois student, whether this is something that particularly resonates with them.
I think, like a lot of things, it's sort of a buzzword, and it catches people's attention. By and large, I would say the majority of university students probably don't think about it. The majority of us don't think about it probably when we go and we buy a shirt. We don't usually look in the tag and see where it was produced or consider the labor record of the company that produced it. And also one of the challenges is that those things sort of change. And so while there was a great surge against Nike now that sort of still continues, Nike has been targeted as kind of the leader as far as abuses because they're kind of the leader in the industry. The fact that Nike has pushed so far and now is probably a leader on the other side of the spectrum and kind of pioneering the way for some of the workers' rights things, which is not to say that they're doing all that they could be doing. They aren't. But, you know, it creates a difficult challenge for students who want to stay focused and need to be united, but who the companies respond. And so there's a question of how who you target next and what do you do? What's the best forum for this sort of discussion? My hope is that the discussion moves from specifically just targeting Nike to looking at broader considerations. I think there's also important considerations to the larger questions such as what is the appropriate relationship between the university and corporations in general, particularly a public university? You know, what sort of relationships they have? What sort of investments are outside companies making in the engineering program and the sciences program and a lot of different areas, and what's the relevance there? I think that there are certainly a good number of student activists on campus who are intent on this issue and do a good job at bringing it up. My hope is that they stay informed. And continue to seek out information on the website, at Nike's website as well as other websites, and maintain a sort of balanced view, because there are a lot of sites out there that are not updated. As much information is conveyed over the internet nowadays, there's also a lot of misinformation, and it's important that you kind of verify and do some of your own research as you explore this issue. And while it's difficult for some students to do, there are a lot of resources available, and I hope that that continues to happen. I don't know, maybe it's because I visited factories in the U.S. I haven't been contacted by very many students, though my name and email address are on the site there, and nobody's contacted me personally yet as far as asking about what my experiences were outside of what I wrote in my report.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the sort of the conventional perception has been for some time that student activism is not what it once was. Maybe that's that's what people who were student activists before you were born maybe would to say, oh, the kids today, you know, they're not politically involved. although in fact, we certainly know that they are, and there does seem to be a growing kind of student activism, partly organized around these very kinds of issues. I wonder what you could say about the state of student activism and whether you in fact think that it's something that is growing and has the potential to be even more than it is now.
Absolutely. I think it kind of goes through cycles like a lot of things, and I think that there has been a resurgence of university students in general becoming more and more committed and involved in organizations. I think that some good examples of that on this campus include the Graduate Employee Organization, GEO, looking to, you know, organize graduate students. There's also a look at I know there's a student group that was protesting against Procter & Gamble and the different animal testing that they did. I worked for P&G over the summer, and I had some interesting discussions with them about how accurate some of that information was. But there's also issues, obviously, at this campus around the chief, and there's a very active student body. So I feel pretty good about that. I hope students continue to stay concerned and focused on this issue. I hope that they also stay open-minded and look for resolution as opposed to just antagonism, that they look for constructive solutions to some of these problems. But I think a lot of them are. I've been very impressed.
We just have a couple of minutes, and now we've just gotten in two callers, and I don't think we'll be able to get them both. We'll do at least one. Urbana, line one. Hello?
Yeah, this will be quick. I've been listening to you somewhat praise Nike, and it seems to me that they'd be quite willing to comply with a lot of requests. If, as long as they can keep their tremendous profit margin, which I understand is really, you know, almost criminal. And I just wanted to ask, how much of what you requested of Nike had any impact on the bottom line? Did anything you had them or were looking for them to do cost them money? I mean, real money.
There was a substantial financial commitment just to organizing this program, both on the part of staff and on the part of them flying. I mean, we didn't obviously pay for ourselves to go and fly to these places. So there was a substantial financial commitment in that respect. Nike as a company does have a substantial profit margin, but it's one that hasn't continued to grow. I think they're facing fiercer competition, and I haven't looked at their stock price recently, but their stock has not been skyrocketing. I know that if you look at their most recent annual report, they pretty much held flat in this past year, that it's not, you know, increasing. And so I think part of that is a result of these sorts of efforts, and I think that may be true industry-wide, though I have no basis for that statement, but that just seems to be my sense. As these issues become larger priorities, universities are contributing money towards the cause, and companies like Nike are now forced to take this seriously and to invest in a serious amount of both labor and employee time as well as financial time to these organizations to support the activities that are ongoing, and I hope they continue to do so.
Well, there we'll have to leave it because we're at the end of the time, but certainly for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, John Dolly, he'll be talking about some of his experiences and about these issues at the Friday Forum at the University Y, which is at 1001 South Wright down on the campus. So the talk gets underway a little bit past noon, and it's free, and anybody who wants to attend should certainly feel welcome. And I'm certain also that on future programs we'll be discussing some of these issues again. So it won't be the last word we'll have on it. Thanks, John, for being here.
Certainly. Thank you, David.
Broadcast of our program, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Today's broadcast also made possible in part by Indiana Community Foundations, providing a service to Indiana citizens by facilitating charitable giving while supporting new and existing local nonprofit organizations. Information is available at the toll-free number 866-22-I-GIVE. Or 866-244-8255. 4483. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Michael Patrick Hearn. He's a scholar who's done a lot of writing on the work of L. Frank Baum, the man who created The Wizard of Oz. It's 100 years old this year, and we'll talk about that in the next part of the show. First, though, we'll take a break for an update on the market, so please stay tuned.